days of wine and roses. Laugh and run away.
This is Joanne Salisbury Troxell, and welcome to the Poet's Corner. April is National Poetry Month, and with me today to celebrate is Carolyn Panay. Thank you, Carolyn, for being here. We've done so many readings together, and it's always been fun. Women Poets at Beale, do you remember that, Carolyn?
Of course I do.
Remember the guys had a poetry reading and hadn't invited us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said, what the heck is this about? And they did a good program, really
mm-hmm.
good.
Yeah.
So we decided to have our own.
We had our own. Yeah.
And so it was you and I and June.
Mm-hmm.
And we rounded up everybody we could think of and had this wonderful night. And I think that was the first time the three of us were together, those many years ago at Bell Park.
At Bell Park, when we read together for the first time. Yeah, what a memory. What a memory. Yeah.
Well, you're one of my favorite poets, and you live in this town. And I know that you're from Wales, but I'd like to ask you a little bit about your background. How do you get from Wales to London to Bozeman?
I sometimes ask myself the same question. How did I make it here? Well, I made it here from the Midwest, but originally, of course, from the UK. So it's a long story, Joanne. How much of this story do you really want?
I want your whole life later.
All right, okay. I was born in Milford Haven, South Wales, in 1943, when my father, who was with RAF Bomber Command, was away at World War II. And he and I didn't see each other, in fact, until 1945, the end of the war here. Meanwhile, my mother took me to live in a tiny seaside village with my aunt, who also had a small daughter, my cousin, born in the same year. And both women took care of us and waited for the war to end. At one point, by the way, Tenby, which is in South Wales and not far away from where we were, a few miles away, was actually bombed. But otherwise, we didn't actually have to face close bombing or much activity from the war. We were removed from it at that time. So I was born, yes, practically on the beach in South Wales and lived there for a while, but mostly grew up actually away from Wales in the south of England, in Oxfordshire, in Henley-on-Thames, on the river, actually, in the 50s. But came into my own in the 60s, probably, listening to the Beatles and the Stones and studying in France and Spain and going to London University, where I studied French and Spanish. So that's part of the story, but...
That's a great one. Henley, are you talking about the place where they had the great boat?
The Great Regatta, the very well called Royal Regatta. Not any regatta, the Royal Regatta.
The Royal Regatta.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yeah. I was there once when they had that.
When were you there, Joe?
Oh, gosh, that was many, many years ago. But what I remember is people just... so crazed about this mm-hmm. regatta.
Yes, yes.
And the way the people were dressed.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I mean, dressed in hats and mm-hmm. gloves and beautiful gowns.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, it was formal.
Mm-hmm. And the men in very gaudy colors often. With
yes.
blazers and ties. Fantastic. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and yeah. the excitement. Yeah. Oh, that yeah. is interesting. So that's where you grew up, that
yeah,
beautiful
and,
place.
And one milestone, actually, of those years was seeing the Russians come and compete for the very first time on our waters and in that Royal Regatta, and noting how efficiently they rowed, very jerkily. There was no beautiful grace to the rowing, but they won a lot of races.
Well, I could just see you as a little girl there, really, having such fun with all of that.
Yeah, I did. It was an interesting upbringing.
And the Russians do have a way of winning things, because it's like, is not so much soul as it is body, mind.
Well, they were on a mission, I tell you. They really were when they first came to Henley. They really were.
Yeah.
So to go back to the French and Spanish, you know, I was basically studying languages all the way through school, and very much under the influence of my mother, who was a linguist, spoke very, very good French, and also a lover of poetry. And she was the one, really, who first introduced me to the Anglo-Welsh poets. She did not speak Welsh, but her father was Welsh-speaking. His first language was Welsh. He was from Abergwilly in South Wales. But she grew up, really, Anglo-Welsh in Pembrokeshire, which is an Anglo-Welsh county in Wales. However, she fell in love with the cadences of Welsh. And she was the one who first introduced me to the Welsh poetry, to mostly the Anglo-Welsh poets, and above all, of course, to Dylan Thomas. So the Welsh cadences and the bardic tradition from Wales, those have influenced me all my life. I've you know, basically from a very, very early age, I'm looking at the book, the collection of Dylan Thomas's poems that my mother bought in 1953, and shared with me I was 10 years old.
Oh, that is just such a wonderful story, and no wonder. You couldn't help but be a poet, Carolyn.
I couldn't help it.
I mean, language is your forte. There's just no doubt about it. Well, when you were teaching here at MSU, well, first of all, how did you happen to get to teach here at MSU?
How did I get here? I sometimes ask that question myself, My husband, Chris, I met at Brown University in the town of Providence in the language lab in 1968. He buzzed me on the language lab, and I turned around, and there was this very tall man with a huge smile. And so, you know, we hit it off from the word go, actually, and discovered that we both had French names. He was a Chris Pinet, and I was a Caroline Petit. So, I mean, fate brought us together.
I mean,
there was
destiny
no
and words again.
No fighting it. So he was a flatlander from Kansas. But he had in his youth, he had discovered the mountains on vacations. And when he saw the opportunity to come west and settle, he didn't hesitate. And he applied for a position in teaching French at MSU. That was in 1981. With little idea, I had no idea what I was in for, right? But I was convinced that this would be an adventure. So I followed him out. At that time, we had two small children. We arrived here in midsummer and settled into the Rat Hole. The Rat Hole was the name my son, Dylan, who was little at the time, gave to the broken-down faculty housing billet that we were accorded when we arrived.
You know, those were barracks.
They were barracks.
Yes.
Those were barracks. Yeah.
We lived in those barracks when first went to college.
You did too. You
lived
in
one.
Do you remember they were green?
Yes. And they were army barracks that this president had gotten on a deal, and they were cheap.
Absolutely.
And cold.
And I can tell you that the first snows, we were there for the first snows, and the snow came in under the door into our living room.
We looked out on a field of snow from September 1st. Mm-hmm. I never will forget that. And it went on until June.
Yeah.
And we couldn't start cars. And if anybody got a car started, we all jumped in it and went downtown. And the little kids, their little feet were always kind of red, and their noses were always running.
That was cold. That was really cold those days.
Oh, gosh. Oh, great initiation into Montana.
So I've lived here for 40 years, which is unbelievable. This is actually my 40th year.
It is unbelievable. So,
you have to ask me the question, does that make me a Montanan?
Absolutely.
Do I qualify? I actually hold two passports, a US one and a UK one I've hung on to. But at heart, honestly, I'm an internationalist and hold great, great affection for other places on this planet, especially France, Spain, and Argentina.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, you know, in my travels around, I was thinking last night about if somebody asked me, where, you know, what was your favorite country? And I just kept thinking of the Baltic. I kept thinking of of the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, my English speaking would be London.
London's
for
a
sure.
Great town. Yeah.
So Bozeman's kind of a far cry from all of those places, but you taught, how is it that you taught Spanish at the university?
They needed a Spanish teacher back in the day. They needed somebody I initially taught actually a lot of history classes for the Department of History and Philosophy, and they needed somebody with a European background who could teach some European history. So that's what I originally actually started teaching.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I taught with all those good people in history and philosophy, Mike Malone, all those good folks there, you know.
Wonderful staff.
People. Yeah, wonderful.
Yes.
But I was also always connected through Chris and to the Department of Modern Languages. And so they pulled me in for whatever they needed. They pulled me in for French classes, Spanish classes, in language classes, lit classes, the lot. Eventually, you know, I it was great because I had these amazing opportunities to teach all over the place. But ending up in later years with the honors program, and sort of taught a lot of honors classes, which involved Latin American literature especially. Which
you
is
know,
my
it's
forte,
interesting.
You know?
A person like you, Carolyn. Yeah. You weren't on the tenure track, were you?
No, I was not. No,
you know what I call
us. I still published.
Oh yes, you know you're a six in one person.
Yeah.
I mean, they get such a bargain with a person like you because you can fit into all of these places that are necessary and excel. We're lucky to have you.
Well, I was also lucky to have the opportunities that I had. Because I think that MSU, they were looking for a lot of different things, but there was also a great deal of flexibility in my time. So
yes.
I had opportunities then that I might not have now to spread my wings and discover all kinds of wonderful
writers. You know, it's true, isn't
yeah,
it, that
yeah.
there was a time at the university when, you know, I was a grad student and I taught up there as a grad student, got a stipend. And then about 6-7 years later, things started to change. And for that same position to teach, they were interviewing PhDs.
Right, yes.
It
yes,
was
yes,
just
became,
amazing
yeah, mm-hmm.
how the change.
Things did change. Yeah.
Yes,
they did.
Great change.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you were teaching Spanish literature and Spanish, did you teach Neruda?
I did, among other things. Of course I taught Neruda, because he is one of the great poets of
absolutely.
The 20th century, really, not just of Latin America. So, yes, indeed I did. Yeah. As well as Lorca, wonderful Lorca.
Oh, yes, really Lorca, wonderful, too.
Yes.
And
yes.
Neruda, I've always really, really wanted to speak Spanish, because the book of poetry that I got, my brother gave to me, had Neruda in English on one side and Spanish. And so I would read it in English and my brother
would read it in
Spanish, even though we were like parrots. We didn't know what we were saying, except we had a vague idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And this great opportunity, maybe you would read us a poem in Neruda.
I would be happy to. Let me find the beginning of this poem. So would you like me to read it in English in the translation? Probably.
Well, I think it'd be fun for you to read it in English and then read it in Spanish.
Okay, let me.
Because it's so beautiful, the language.
Okay. Tonight I can write the saddest lines. Write, for example, the night is starry and the stars are blue and shiver in the distance. The night wind revolves in the sky and sings. Tonight I can write the saddest lines. I loved her, and sometimes she loved me too. Through nights like this, I held her in my arms. I kissed her again and again under the endless sky. She loved me. Sometimes I loved her too. How could one not have loved her great still eyes? Tonight I can write the saddest lines. To think that I do not have her, to feel that I have lost her, to hear the immense night still more immense without her, and the verse falls to the soul like dew to the pasture. What does it matter that my love could not keep her? The night is starry and she is not with me. This is all. In the distance, someone is singing. In the distance, my soul is not satisfied that it has lost her. My sight tries to find her as though to bring her closer. My heart looks for her and she is not with me. The same night whitening, the same trees, we of that time are no longer the same. I no longer love her, that's certain, but how I loved her. My voice tried to find the wind to touch her hearing. Another's, she'll be another's, as she was before my kisses. Her voice, her bright body, her infinite eyes. I no longer love her, that's certain, but maybe I love her. Love is so short, forgetting is so long. Because through nights like this one, I held her in my arms. My soul is not satisfied that it has lost her. Though this be the last pain that she makes me suffer, and these the last verses that I write for her.
Oh, that is so wonderful. He knew about love.
He did, from an early age.
It's wonderful, those 100 poems, love poems. Mm-hmm. I mean, you read one and it's just like you have to go to the next one. Mm-hmm. You want to read that in Spanish?
Well, it's long in Spanish, so how about I read the last part of it? How about otherwise, this is going to go on for a long time. So, okay. So I'll go from, I no longer love her, that's certain, but how I loved her, right? Yo no la quiero, es cierto, pero cuánto la quise. Mi voz buscaba el viento para tocar su oído. De otro, será de otro, como antes de mis besos. Su voz, su cuerpo claro, sus ojos infinitos. Ya no la quiero, es cierto, pero tal vez la quiero. Es tan corto el amor y es tan largo el olvido. Porque en noches como esta la tuve entre mis brazos. Mi alma no se contenta con haberla perdido. Aunque este sea el último dolor que ella me causa. Y estos sean los últimos versos que yo le escribo.
Oh, I'm glad you read it in English first.
Really?
It sounds beautiful in Spanish.
It's incredible in Spanish.
I bet it is. You've got it a is. Secret knowledge about what that is like, mm-hmm. because yeah. of your bilingual, trilingual mind. Tell me this, Carolyn. Does it match up in English?
It's not a bad translation, but obviously the cadences in Spanish carry the poem. The rhythm, all of it, the sounds, the rhythm. Yeah.
It's amazing,
It's hard to be a good translator. It's hard to get it. But I mean, it does come across quite well in English, I will
yes.
say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you yeah. so much. That was a real treat. You know, you were a great reader of poets and poetry, and every time I meet you, it seems like you have a new book and you've discovered, and it's always so wonderful. And, of course, I'm thinking of your mother. And how she yeah. was bilingual and mm-hmm. like Dylan Thomas
right.
and
right.
and yeah. I am really, really fascinated with Dylan Thomas and continue to be ever mm-hmm. since I read Fern Hill, the first mm-hmm. poem of his I ever yeah. read. And remember Glover Wagner teaching that class on Dylan.
Yeah, fantastic. It was wonderful.
I mean,
yeah.
Carolyn, wasn't that amazing?
It was. It really was.
I mean, we got mm-hmm. a whole different Dylan mm-hmm. Thomas mm-hmm. there. And it just was such a delving into mm-hmm. the secret world of the poet's mind mm-hmm. and spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I read a book about Dylan Thomas once, and I loved a couple of things that stand out to mm-hmm. me now is that he loved, when he came to America on a tour and actually died here, but he loved the 5-cent candy bar. And he would buy 6 or 8 of these candy bars and eat them every day.
Every day, yeah.
You know, I mean, in between shots of liquor or whatever.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
And he also went to a very posh dinner party in New York. And he went upstairs at one point, and he came down dressed in the host's clothes. He went into the host closet, picked out what he wanted to wear, and came down. Yeah. And there was sort of stunned silence. And I don't know how that was ever resolved, but like so many things with Dylan, how did you resolve them?
I think he got away with a lot, Joanne.
Anyway, one of his famous poems is "Do not go gentle into that good night." Should we read that together?
Absolutely. You start.
You start.
Okay. All right. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
The wise men at their end know dark is right. Because their words have forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night.
Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight, and learned too late they grieved it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night.
Grave men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
And you, my father, there on that sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. It's fun.
Yeah,
and it's something about it is very, very wonderful. And no wonder people remember it. It says so many. And I was always interested in how there's one sound, right, night, day, light, right, right. I mean, how he's managed that villanelle form in the rhyme scheme and the repetition of lines. But poets like Dylan can do anything.
And that urgency, the tremendous urgency about trying to stop this momentous thing that's happening, that he's losing his father. That is so beautifully echoed in the poem.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know, rather than that idea of going peaceful, you know, people say they died peacefully.
Oh, right, exactly.
You know, he's saying, life is too much, too great, too profound, and worth raging against the light. I love that poem. Yeah.
Wonderful, yeah.
So there is another poem of his that speaks to the writing of poetry. And in my craft and gentle art, maybe you would read that, because it seems to me that it says something to poets that's really kind of true.
Yes, this is an interesting poem because it's very accessible and it's relatively simple. I will go ahead and read it. It's "In My Craft or Sullen Art." In my craft or sullen art, exercised in the still night, when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labor by singing light, not for ambition or bread or the strut and trade of charms on the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret hearts. Not for the proud man apart from the raging moon I write on these spendthrift pages, nor for the towering dead with their nightingales and psalms, but for the lovers, their arms around the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my craft or art.
You know, in other words, You do it because you have to.
You do it because you have to, because it's a healthy or unhealthy urgency.
You, yeah, right. Some sort of neurosis.
Why am I doing this? I don't know.
Yeah,
why I'm doing.
Right. A wonderful neurosis.
Right.
That keeps you awake at night. Do you have any other Dylan poems that you want to read at this point?
I think that's good for now.
Okay,
I mean, there are many, you know, Fernhill, of course, is a wonderful, wonderful poem well known, but the cadences in Fernhill are just fabulous.
You know, I wanted to ask you, why do you think he wrote in English rather than Welsh?
Well, he did not grow up bilingual. He grew up with Welsh parentage, with grandparents who did, you know, and aunts and so forth. So he heard a lot of Welsh. He also grew up in the Welsh chapels, where he heard the howl, though a lot of, you know, a great deal of Welsh. But there was already a tradition of Anglo-Welsh poetry in Wales, actually, you know, which my mother actually introduced me to along with Dylan. So, I think he wanted to use the English language. It was a choice. It was a choice.
It was
a choice. He went to a grammar school in Swansea, where English was spoken more than Welsh. He grew up with Yeats, with all the great poets, and I think that was the language that he chose. It was a choice. But his first language was not Welsh, as my grandfather's was. So that's the difference too.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because he gets English, but he gets that Welsh lilt.
The Welsh intonation. That's what's so incredible. That's why his poetry is unique, really.
That's why I like to listen to his own recordings, too.
Although we do hear, I mean, there are earlier poets like Hopkins, who there's a clear influence.
Oh, yes.
You know, of
some of
the poetry. But still, he is unique, really, in his time.
Yeah. Well, you know, Carolyn, this brings us to yourself as a poet. You've had these wonderful influences. So when did you start writing poetry? What was the impulse? In other words, how did that work for you?
I just think that as I sort of read poetry with my mother very early and heard the cadences, I think it charmed me. I think it was a charm. And so, you know, I read poets. I was, I was moved early by a poem like "When I Was But 14 or So, I Walked Into a Golden Land. Chimborazo, Cotopaxi took me by the hand. My father died, my mother too. They passed like fleeting dreams," and so forth. So in other words, the poetry took over in the poem. And that's probably a little bit what happened to me. I also loved Masefield, "I Must Go Down to the Sea Again, to the Lonely Sea and the Sky."
Yeah.
"And all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer me by." Fantastic stuff. And because I was born next to the ocean. I mean, remember, you know, the UK, it's a small island. So you're always being buffeted somewhere or the other by waves. So, you know, Masefield was a great poet for us. And then, of course, you know, moving on a little bit more to Wordsworth, you know, "Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who would pass a sight so touching in its majesty," etc., etc. So the stuff resonated with me. I mean, it was in my school, at home, all of it. I just grew up with this stuff, and it stayed with me.
That's so interesting, because the poetic tradition, when you talk about your mother, I remember my mother reciting poems.
So you were the same,
And one of the things, like when I was in high school and I was reading "I Must Go Down to the Sea Again," and I would come home and read it out loud. This is what we did. And my mother would say, "Oh, yes." And there was a connection between my poetry when I'd read Wordsworth Intimations of Immortality, Trailing Clouds of Glory. Mm-hmm. And my mother could pick it up.
Sure.
And so there was a connection.
Connection also. Yes.
And I don't know if that connection between what you read poetically in school and whether it translates when you go home or not.
I think it did. Obviously, it did with you, and it did with me. So
yes,
so.
And it made a difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, somehow the rhythms of that were fascinating, just like children like rhythms so much.
Yeah, and that's true to the music. Yeah. The musical side of that was huge. It's huge in Dylan Thomas, too, obviously.
Oh, it's so... So let's hear one of your poems, or two, or three, or four.
Okay, what do I have here? Okay, I'll start. I might as well start with a seasonal one.
Oh, April, because it's poetry month. Yes, poetry I love month. That poem.
So this is April Improv. I'm standing on the deck of my house, and I'm chirping. The neighbors must be thinking, poor thing, is this yet another untracked symptom of COVID-19? The sky is so blue, it's almost an affront, and the clouds float overhead, puffy, innocuous. I'm wondering if this is at last the Montana spring. In the empty churchyard, a teenage girl is skateboarding with her little brother. Laughing, she flies with the wind, and standing on my deck, I hear a bird sing, not just a handful of notes, but a repeated, haunting passage, the kind that Miles might produce on his horn or Yo-Yo on his cello. It's otherwise quiet, except for distant children's voices and a breeze in the bells. It's then I realize that I'm hearing a summons. I start to whistle, echo the bird, and I recognize this is madness, but the sound I produce seems to convince, and from the tree, it answers me in kind. Suddenly, despite the pandemonium of this April, we are in tune. Here we are, singing together. First, the bird's winsome refrain, then, against all odds, mine.
You know, I love that, Carolyn, because it sort of exonerates me from madness.
The truth is coming out. I'm not alone.
Yeah. And I stand on the crows are going, caw, caw, caw. I'm like, what the hell is it? What is it you want? Shut up for a while, would you?
Yeah, right. Oh, God.
Oh. Here we are. You have a granddaughter that you've written some really wonderful poems about. And 10 years old, and that is nothing but wisdom of flying through the house and a future, such a great future.
Right. I have to say, during the pandemic, while we've been living with COVID, we've also been living at least half time, sometimes more, with my granddaughter, who's about to turn 10. And she's been doing distance learning the whole time because of various people in the family who have health challenges. So she's been my inspiration and my hope. I mean, and sometimes my frustration too. I mean, it's not all. She's full of beans, you know, and she's not shy about expressing herself. But anyway, this is through her eyes. This is a longer poem about my dear Naomi Rose, whom we call Mimi. Through her eyes. It's all wonderful and terrible. The two extremes touch, then ignite. And she's off, inflamed by a spark, astride the grown-up bike with the scarlet grips. Angels fly and take themselves lightly. No angel she, but how she flies into the sunset of her high summer. Time lets her play in the startled moment, all five senses honed and keen. Moths, fireflies, a cloud of gnats, she knows it's all hers, and she offers it to us. Not the thing we take for granted, a mote stuck in the eye, but a wide open, novel and lavish vista. The one Rothko painted those many times, set against impenetrable darkness, or Frankl's saving vision in the soul-crushing camp. There she stands, tall with her bike, looking out to the peaks, swathed in crimson gold and deepest charcoal. She's erect, long-limbed, and her face is rapt, on the cusp of something greater, unknown. It's her first 5 miles, and she's utterly fearless. And we, ignorant of how little we know, relish her singular moment. Remember now what we have lost, silvery leaves and intricate roots, mysterious rustling in the topmost branches, all within reach, and open to us. What else could possibly be on offer as the sun sinks into a stippled sea and she points towards home? But yes, there's more. The full moon rises, a fine and lucky coin, or a tambourine shaken in gypsy rhythm. It's Larkin's lovely lozenge, sweet Phoebe's song. Off she goes at full tilt, flying down the hill, wheels whir, bell rings. No stopping her now.
That's really wonderful. And you know, I'm thinking of Mimi when she's 18, 28, 38, reading a poem like that from her grandmother.
Maybe. Who knows?
Well,
who knows?
It might be 58 or 60.
Right, exactly. We don't know. Yeah.
You know, we're drawing to a close here. And before we leave, I would like to ask you about this wonderful project that is in the foreground of your life right now.
Yes, I feel very, very lucky and privileged to be in touch with a wonderful trio, musical trio of women called Haven. And they have been reading my poems, the poems from my collection, Tangos, Tamarex, and the Other Woman. And they have picked poems they want to put to music, and they want to compose, and they want to record. So we're in the middle of this project, and I'm not sure when exactly it will come to fruition, maybe the end of this year, maybe sometime next year. But this weekend, they have asked me to record, actually, one of the poems that they're going to use. Let me see if I can find it here. I'll find it in a minute. But anyway, it's it's a poem that they are going to work with, but they wanted to hear my voice. So I'm going to see if I can. What have I done with it?
You could never find them in these books, would you?
No, I know.
Whoever memorized the pages of your old poems, you
no,
know.
I lost it. Wait a minute.
Yeah, I just thought, too.
Here it is, this page. Okay. Here we go. All right, here we go.
Okay, let's hear it.
All right, so here's the poem that they're...
And you're going to read this.
Yeah, and who knows? I don't know what they're going to do with this. But all I can tell you is that the trio is composed of a voice, a clarinet, and piano. And you can find them online, the Haven Trio. Okay.
They are very experimental.
Very experimental.
And this is
wonderful.
Going to be wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting. So the poem is called, it's a very short poem. It's called Hardwired for Optimism. And the little caption is, always look on the bright side of life, Eric Idle, Monty Python's Life of Brian. Okay. Hardwired for Optimism. Frontal cortex, hippocampus, amygdala. The sun, the tune that sings in my brain, also sang in yours. A congruence of tides. I don't know why. Today I frolicked with a black dog and a white dog in icy shards and snow. Tomorrow I'll die. Amygdala, hippocampus, frontal cortex. Sing that song again, the brain's mad and hopeful refrain.
We'll look so forward to when that is finally produced, and do keep in touch with us about that.
I will do, will do.
And before we close, there's a poet that you are just enamored of right now. We don't know what will happen tomorrow to you, the next book.
True.
But Lee Young-ri, and I always like to say he's an American poet from Jakarta, Indonesia. It just makes me happy to say those words. So would you read a poem from him?
I would. This is a wonderful poet. He's extraordinary. He's a poet who has written about the political turmoil that he and his family fled from. But he is also a most lyrical poet, too. So he manages to combine both political concerns with beautiful lyricism. This is spoken for from his collection, The Undressing. I didn't know I was blue until I heard her sing. I was never aware so much had been lost before even I was born. There was so much to lose even before I knew what it meant to choose. Born blue, living blue unconfessed, blue in concealment, I've lived all my life at the plinth of greater things than me. Morning is greater with its firstborn light and birdsong. Noon is taller, though a moment's realm. Evening is ancient and immense, and night's storied house more huge. But I had no idea and would have died without a clue, except she began to sing. And I understood my soul is a bride enthralled by an unmet groom, or else the groom wholly spoken for, blue in ardor, happy in eternal waiting. I heard her sing and knew I would never hear the true name of each thing until I realized the abysmal ground of all things. Her singing touched that ground in me. Now dying of my life, everything is made new. Now my life is not my life. I have no life apart from all of life. And my death is not my death, but a pillow beneath my head, a rock propping the window open to admit the jasmine. I heard her sing and I'm no longer afraid. Now that I know that she knows, I hope never to forget how giant the gone and immaculate the going, how much I've already lost, how much I go on losing, how much I've lived all one blue. Oh, how much I go on living.
Thank you so much, Carolyn Panay. Thank you, thank you. This is Joanne Salisbury Troxell from the Poet's Corner. Sip the wine of life, smell the ephemeral roses, and read a poem. A poem by Neruda, a poem by Lee, a poem by Dylan Thomas. Thanks for listening. Bye now.